This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, adoption, abortion, and choice in America. In the early 2000s, Abby Johnson was a teenager living outside Charlotte, North Carolina, in an evangelical Christian household.
She was really steeped in purity culture.
That's journalist TJ Raphael.
She did a purity pledge to her father on her 13th birthday. He presented her with a ring. It was the same ring that her two older sisters had received after doing the same ritual where they pledged to remain virgins until they found a husband.
Abby was homeschooled and didn't receive any sex education. Then she met a boy in her homeschool community named Nathan.
By the time Abby turns 16, you know, sparks start to fly between her and Nathan, and they end up dating in secret because they're both not allowed to date.
Abby gets pregnant. She knows she doesn't want an abortion, but she hides her pregnancy at first. She is terrified of what her parents are going to say, but eventually she tells them.
Abby's mother is shocked, and Abby's father tells her that as her God-ordained authority, the baby belongs to him, not to her. And his choice is that she will place the child for adoption.
This is happening around 2008. Abby's parents send her to a maternity home in Lynchburg, Virginia, called the Liberty Godparent Home. Maternity homes are facilities that provide temporary housing and other services to pregnant people, and in some cases, their newborns. It's at this home that Abby says she was coerced and shamed into giving up her son for adoption. TJ tells Abby's story and others who had similar experiences at the same home in the new podcast Liberty Lost from Wondery. It's a gripping look at maternity homes, their rise in the decades before Roe v. Wade, their resurgence after the overturning of Roe in 2022, and the dangers of framing adoption as the only alternative to abortion. The series also explores what meaningful support could look like for pregnant people who want to parent but lack the resources. I started by asking TJ about the history of the Liberty Godparent Home, which is on the campus of the evangelical college Liberty University.
Liberty University was started by Jerry Falwell, who was the controversial evangelical preacher, a televangelist. Falwell was really the architect of the moral majority, which is sort of the precursor for what we see now in the modern evangelical right. And Jerry Falwell was an ardent opponent of abortion in the early 1970s. And Falwell had this idea where he thought that if he could show the United States that America did not need abortion because we had the option of adoption, that there would be the political will to overturn Roe versus Wade and eventually outlaw abortion nationwide. Mm. So he started in 1982 the Liberty Godparent Home. It sat on the campus and still does to this day of the university Falwell founded, Liberty University. And the godparent home said that it would take in unwed pregnant girls and young women between the ages of 12 and 21, provide them with shelter, make sure their medical costs were covered, and then give them a pathway towards adoption or parenting. And he marketed this maternity home to his own followers. He used his television show, The Old Time Gospel Hour, which at one point was reaching 50 million people, to do hour-long specials on this maternity home. He told his followers, if your daughter's in trouble, you can send them here.
Many of them come here confused. Some come very hostile. Many of them come bitter. But they've come here to give birth to a child. The majority place their children for adoption, as we're an adoption agency. We make some wonderful Christian families very happy by placing their babies in their arms.
And Falwell himself said that adoptive parents needed to be born again, Christian committed young people because they wanted these children to go to the quote unquote right kinds of families. Mm. And so in their minds, the pure and sinless baby should be matched up with the, you know, pure married couple, because otherwise it would equate to celebrating sinful behavior to keep this pure baby with this sinful mother.
Mm. And just to say, part of the draw also was this promise that part or full ride would be paid for at Liberty University afterward, right? So it was an additional sort of incentive for young women to agree to go through the process and to stay there for the entirety of their pregnancies.
Yes. Yeah. Scholarships, you know, according to former residents and former staffers that I spoke to, one former staffer told me that it was, quote, used as a leverage point. I've looked through hundreds of original documents that are in the Liberty University archives that are materials related to the godparent home. They never seem to put information about the scholarship in writing. In the United States, it is illegal to exchange cash for a baby. But I think in talking to former staffers, one of the reasons they'd never wanted to kind of put the scholarship information in writing or really spell it out is because it could be seen as a transaction. Mm. You know, the women I spoke to, and even since the series has released, I've been getting emails from people who said, you know, I wanted the scholarship, but then I kept my child and I wasn't offered it. So for the most part, yeah, it seems like the scholarship was only given to girls who placed their children for adoption.
Which, is it fair to say, was most of these women?
Yes, yes,
young
exactly.
Young women, I should say, girls and women. Mm-hmm. Some of them are under 18.
Exactly, yes.
So it's 2008 when Abby ends up at this home. What is her experience like there? I mean, she's 3 months pregnant when she shows up.
Right. Yeah. She describes an environment of intense isolation, pressure, coercion, and religious manipulation.
Some of it can get a little hazy, of course, because some of the weeks blurred together. It was definitely a traumatic haze.
She describes not being able to make phone calls freely.
I was given 2 30-minute phone calls a week that my parents got to decide who I was allowed to talk to, and it was always them.
While she's making these phone calls, there's a chaperone right there. She could not freely leave the maternity home without a chaperone.
I was told all these doors and windows are locked. If you try to open that window after hours or during the day, an alarm will go off.
And inside the home, the girls were not permitted really to talk about their pregnancies, to talk about what they wanted to do in the future. Abby and the other women, former residents of the godparent home who I spoke to, described that when they would express to their counselors, I want to keep my child, I don't want to do this, what are my options, can we create a plan, it would be turned back on them. The question would be flipped and say, well, how would you do this? Hmm. You explain it to me. And, you know, these are teenage girls who are living in isolation. Even in 2008, they didn't have free access to a computer to look up resources online. And so Zoe Shaw, one of the women I spoke to, she said, you know, in that way, I felt so helpless because I didn't know how to make it work as a 16-year-old. And I was asking them, the counselor, for help.
And just to say, in a lot of this time, I mean, months are passing. Abby hasn't spoken to Nathan, the father of her child. Where does Nathan fall in all of this? And again, you spoke with him for the podcast.
Yes. So she's about 8 months pregnant when he learns she's even been sent to this maternity home in Lynchburg, Virginia. He was told by Abby's parents that she never wanted to speak with him again. After the pregnancy comes to light, he has an in-person meeting with them where they threaten to charge him with statutory rape. Nathan is 2 years older than Abby. He was 18. She was 16. And they suggest that they might file these charges against him. He asks, you know, did Abby say that I raped her? And her parents say, no, she didn't say that, but it doesn't matter. It's up to me and what I say. Nathan is terrified of this threat, and so are his parents. They don't really know what to do. You know, they consulted with religious leaders in their community instead of seeking legal advice, and they were told if you get a lawyer, it might push Abby's parents to make good on their threat. So they were trying to basically play nice. Hopefully things would change. Maybe they can talk this through. So for several months, up until Abby has been away for 5 months, he receives a phone call from someone at the godparent home saying that he needs to sign adoption papers. And he's like, wait, Abby's where? I don't understand this. He goes up to the maternity home. He asks to see Abby. They don't allow him. They actually hide all of the pregnant girls out of sight in their rooms so he can't see any of them. And he starts to meet and make appointments with Abby's counselor, trying to show her that he's going to step up and do right by Abby. He says, my help will not come with any strings attached.
I was like, look, I don't know if Abby wants to be with me or not, but like, I'm going to get a place that either I can stay at or she can stay at or we can stay at. I was like, I'll move to a different state for the chance to be able to like support her.
Abby's counselor never communicates to her all of the concrete things Nathan is doing to help support her. And when she talks with Abby, she just says, oh yeah, I've been meeting with Nathan. And Abby thinks that he's just come up here to get information about her pregnancy and doesn't even want to talk to her. So they were both being manipulated by the counselors in a very intentional effort to keep them from speaking to each other, to hopefully form a plan for them to be able to keep and parent their child.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, I mean, even toward the very last days of her pregnancy, Abby is feeling so conflicted about having to choose a couple to adopt the baby. But she feels, as she tells you, really forced to do it. And her mom also plays a pretty big role in how she's feeling about it. Can you talk a little bit about that part of the process?
Yes, absolutely. I believe that the pressure and coercion Abby was facing was twofold. It wasn't just the godparent home. It was her parents, and her mother played a very big role in the adoption. You know, Abby feels like she's going to be forced to do this. She finds a family that she's potentially interested in. They seem like they would support having an open adoption, meaning she would be allowed to have contact as the child grew up. And they fall through. They're no longer an option. And so Abby takes this as a sign from God that she's supposed to keep her son. And she shares this with her mother, and her mother will not hear of it. The godparent home had scrapbooks of profiles of prospective adoptive couples. And she says, we're going to find one together. I'm going to come up. We're going to do this. And Abby describes sitting in the adoption agency, being completely disengaged. And the staff is bringing out scrapbooks and profiles to her mother, allows her mother to flip through them, and they ultimately wind up moving on a process towards placing their son with this couple that Abby's mother had selected. Mm.
Tell me about the birth of the baby. Abby's talked about this. Nathan talks about it because he also was able to meet his own newborn on that day.
Abby gave birth at Virginia Baptist Hospital in Lynchburg. She gets there, she has her sisters there, her mother's present, and the baby is born, and they take the baby over and making sure the baby's healthy, and she's wondering when it's her turn to get to hold the baby. And she describes that even on her hospital bed, she was trying to be a good Southern girl, not to make problems, which I just find so kind of heartbreaking that, you know, you don't even feel empowered to ask, can you hold your own child while you've just given birth to them. But she has 3 days at the hospital. At the end of the 3 days that she has there, a foster family selected by the godparent home will show up to take the child. The child will remain in the custody of the foster family for a period of 10 days. And at the end of that period, a placement ceremony will be done at the godparent home, handing the child over to the adoptive parents. But yeah, in the hospital, Abby holds out hope that her father and her mother will have a change of heart, that once the baby is here, you know, this beautiful infant, their grandson, that they will say to her, you know what, we don't want to lose him either. Let's take him home. We'll figure this out. But at the end of Abby's 3rd day in the hospital, the adoption agency caseworker, Deanne Hamlet, as well as the foster mother come in and they say, you know, it's time to sign the papers. And Abby's sister, Sarah, who I also interviewed, was in the room for this. And Abby describes shaking in her hospital bed, sobbing, holding her son, and being presented with this piece of paper to relinquish her parental rights. And she says, you know, I can't see the paper through my tears.
How am I supposed to sign these papers when I can't see them? And my hand is shaking so hard, I'm not going to be able to sign my signature. And to that, they simply responded, breathe, and it's okay if you can't see, and it's okay if you can't make your signature look pretty.
And her sister Sarah corroborated this moment, and Abby, despite, you know, physically shaking and sobbing and saying she can't do this, she does sign the papers because she feels like no one will help her. And then, yeah, towards the end of this 10-day period, Abby begs her mother to set up a meeting with the adoption agency caseworker. And Abby is desperate at this point. She wants to reverse course on the adoption, as was her legal right at that time. And she asks the caseworker, What are my rights? What can we do?
And she'd say, so what are your plans? And I'd say, I don't know. I don't have plans. I don't have anything. But I'm asking you questions. I don't know what to do, but I feel like I can't live. I can't survive. How am I supposed to go on? You know, like, can someone answer that question? How can I live without him?
And according to Abby, the caseworker looks back at her and says,
could you really live with yourself taking this gift away from this couple? Could you really live with yourself? Me asking how I was supposed to survive, she twisted it around on me and asked me how I could live with destroying strangers. And my mom sat right there and agreed with her. And so my experience is everybody outside of my body agrees that my desire for my child is selfish.
And she says that she just got defeated and ultimately she loses her parental rights to her son.
Mm. It is so devastating to hear her describe what she went through. And the way that she says it, it's like the pain really never went away for her. And TJ, I mean, you continue on with Abby's story in the podcast. You tell us what happened in her life after the adoption goes through. It is an open adoption, and she does end up going to Liberty University on the scholarship that she was offered. And I should say that Liberty Godparent Home still exists today. It's still operating. And it sounds like you did a lot of poking around trying to figure out what kind of oversight exists for a place like this. What did you discover?
Yeah, so in the state of Virginia, a place like Liberty Godparent Home doesn't need a license to operate because it's a faith-based private program. Like, that was pretty shocking to me. It doesn't really seem like there is an oversight body for a private program like this. When it comes to Family Life Services, which is the adoption agency that is physically connected to the godparent home, they also are under the same organization, which is called the Liberty Godparent Foundation. Family Life Services Adoption Agency is still licensed with the state. And I asked the state if they plan to open an investigation, and they would not say whether or not they plan to do that, but instead directed me to an online complaint form. Mm. Liberty University is incredibly powerful. It's the largest economic driver in the region. 5 of the 7 city council members on the Lynchburg City Council have ties to Liberty University or Jerry Falwell's church. A lot of the police officers that work in Lynchburg kind of cycle through working in the public sector to then going to work in public safety on campus at Liberty University. So it seems like there is not a huge appetite to go after this juggernaut institution, at least among local officials. Mm.
And I should point out that, of course, you reached out to Liberty Godparent Home, Liberty University for comment on this podcast, and they did not provide a statement to you. They didn't respond to your requests for comment. They did, however, comment to the local Lynchburg newspaper, which had covered your podcast, and they said that the podcast is attacking their pro-life work. They said they reject the claims of the podcast as irresponsible journalism. Anything you want to say to that?
No, I mean, I'm not surprised by their statement. I do wish they would have spoken to me. I reached out to the Liberty Godparent Home, to Family Life Services, and the university several times via every form of communication. I called, I sent emails, texted, tried to add people on LinkedIn, Facebook. I even sent letters via snail mail, and to date have never received a response. And as it relates to the claim that I'm attacking their pro-life work, I mean, all of the women I spoke to had already decided they didn't want abortions. This is not an issue of these women were trying to get abortions and then they were sent to this maternity home. These women wanted to keep and parent their children. All they wanted was support.
And yet, as you point out, so much of this conversation is so intertwined with Jerry Falwell's messaging on adoption as an alternative to abortion. And of course, with the fall of Roe v. Wade, that conversation has been revived in a really different way. What has happened to the Liberty Godparent Home, but also other homes like it since Roe was overturned.
Yeah, so since the end of Roe, there has been an increase in the number of maternity homes nationwide. More than a third have ties to Heartbeat International, which is the world's largest anti-abortion organization. They have a presence on every inhabited continent. And Heartbeat has an explicit message to promote adoption as an alternative to abortion. And a lot of these maternity homes, I think it's really a roulette wheel depending on the organizations they're affiliated with. Like, I think in theory, maternity homes are serving a need. Mm-hmm. Who goes to a maternity home? You are a pregnant person. Maybe you don't have secure housing. You don't have the support of your family. You don't have a safe partner. Maybe it's a domestic violence situation. And you need shelter while you're pregnant, while you're at the most vulnerable point in your life. And I think that in theory, these places serve a need. But when they are tied to institutions that have a particular worldview that do not support single women who have, you know, ties to purity culture and shame around sex outside marriage, I think that's where things can get really ethically murky.
Mm. And aside from having better oversight over these kinds of maternity homes, what are some other possible solutions that you've been thinking about to make sure that adoption isn't something that's being forced on people who don't really want to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would begin with taking money out of adoption. So the United States is the only sort of Western country that has turned adoption into a business. And it's a multi-billion dollar business, and the product is children. So I think it would begin there. I know places like Germany, for example, or Australia, all adoptions are managed by the state. And adoptions are also done there to prioritize familial adoptions first versus placing a child outside of a family unit. So that might be placing a child with an aunt or with a cousin or something like that. But there's no money exchanged because this is managed by the state. In the United States, we have private adoption agencies that charge fees for adoptions. And there's different kinds of marketing apparatuses that drive this. But I also think it begins with trying to, you know, figure out why women place their children for adoption. The vast majority of people that place their children for adoption do so out of desperation, hardship, and a lack of support. So I think when we talk about solutions, we need to think about family preservation options, and that will look like social services that could benefit any low-income American.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as you're saying all of this, I'm just thinking about recent changes in the big tax and spending bill that's been signed into law now, things like Medicaid being cut, food stamp services being cut, housing assistance being cut. At the same time, the Trump administration is saying that they're pro-families, they're pro-women, they want to see more babies born, they want to see people opting to have more children. How do you square these two things?
I mean, the Project 2025 agenda explicitly says that adoption should be an alternative to abortion and that faith-based adoption agencies should be funded. I think that we do need more pro-family policies to help vulnerable, low-income people stay with their children. And yeah, I talked with the founder of an organization called Saving Our Sisters. And so this is a group of birth mothers who work to help pregnant women in crisis who may be considering adoption because of that crisis. And they say that with every passing year, their work is getting harder, not just because of abortion restrictions, but because of affordability crisis, because of the slashing of social services. And nowadays, most women who are placing children for adoption already have a child at home. And they often feel like, I will find a way by the end of this 9 months to make it work. And things just don't materialize. Mm-hmm. And they want to be a good parent and feel like, I have no other choice here but to place my child for adoption. And so in that way, I think we need to think about choice differently. Because if you are placing your child for adoption because of poverty, is that really an active choice? Is this something that you want to do, or are you doing out of desperation?
Yeah, it's a constrained choice
in
that way. I want to bring this all back to Abby and how she's reflected back on what happened when she was a teenager. I mean, I was so struck by toward the end of the podcast series, you talk about how Abby's mom looks back and feels a lot of regret for how she, her role in really convincing her daughter to go through with this, now that she sees how much pain was caused. Now that you yourself, TJ, have spent all this time talking to these women, what are you left sitting with, and what do you hope people are left sitting with when they hear about what they went through?
I really hope that we can think more deeply about how we support women, how we support pregnant women, how we support single mothers. And I do truly hope people think more deeply about choice, because these birth mothers, most of them, you know, 4 out of 5 that I spoke to felt like it really wasn't a choice for them. Mm. And that is deeply troubling and unsettling. And then the idea that as we, you know, go forward in the United States with fewer avenues to access reproductive care and also constrained social services, I fear that more women will find themselves in this position.
Well, TJ, it's a really moving podcast, really well told. Thank you for coming to talk about it.
Thank you for having me.
You can listen to Liberty Lost from Wondery on Apple Podcasts. We'll include a link for you on our show notes page.